The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, equipping and supporting New York's startup business community with Mac repairs and upgrades, on-site setup and support, free seminars and events, equipment rentals, sales, consultation, and more. Studio.techserve.com. And An American in Paris, the new Tony Award-winning musical that brings the magic and romance of Paris into perfect harmony with the unforgettable songs of George and Ira Gershwin, winner of more awards than any other musical of the year. Tickets at AmericanInParisBroadway.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And this is the way it works, folks. Terrorism 2.0.
When I walked into the departure area, the bomb goes off. It was like pure panic, which was breaking out. You saw people running out, shouting. And soon after that, I think it's between 1 or 2 minutes, you have the second explosion. I said, this is insane. I said, this is insane. This is like a war zone.
Dual explosions, the first believed hidden in luggage, causing panic, the second a suicide bomber exploiting the panic to maximize casualties, a method and a clue into the ISIS-claimed attack at Brussels Airport. Witness Jeff Versailles speaking there as one piece of the puzzle authorities are trying to assemble a day after terrorists brought Belgium to a standstill. As authorities concentrated efforts on the airport, another bomb went off at the Malbec train station, killing 20. The resources deployed at the airport ensured the first responders would have the most difficult possible time making the 7-mile journey to this second scene of carnage. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for the attack, and the timing tempted linking the attack as retaliation for arrests of targets in the ISIS cell in the Brussels neighborhood of Malenbeek, believed responsible for the Paris attacks. It's, quote, still too early to make a direct connection between the attacks in Paris and today's attacks, say authorities. In a moment, we will take a look at the growth of digital forensics as a tool in terrorist investigations of all kinds, with an eye on the dispute between Apple and the federal government over who has the right to break encryption in the pursuit of terrorists. But in the Belgian case, the Friday arrest of Salah Abdeslam, a major player in the Paris attacks, came with the discovery of weapons and detonators from a police raid last week, suggesting that Abdeslam may have intended to participate in yesterday's attacks, and that the attack, rather than being a retaliation, was actually rushed forward to stay ahead of police who seemed to be closing in. To a grieving nation, though, Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel spoke in a voice of resignation that Belgium's luck had finally run out.
Mesdames et messieurs, ce que nous redoutions s'est réalisé.
Ladies and gentlemen, what we feared has happened. Our country and citizens have been hit by a terrorist attack in a violent and cowardly way.
Violent et lâche.
Can Belgium be both the seat of the institutions of the European Union and also a soft underbelly of the European continent? We asked Constanze Stelzenmüller, a Robert Bosch senior fellow with the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution, if Europe is only as secure as its least secure member.
No, I think that that's an exaggeration. It's true, of course, that Europe has porous borders. And my own country, Germany, has borders, land borders, with 10 countries. Yeah? And of course, because of the Schengen Agreement, we have been used to living without borders for a long time and considered that not just as something that was immensely useful and was good for the economy, but also as something of a civilizational achievement. So people are looking at this with these developments with a great deal of regret because they sense that this may be, this may be doomed. Look, the fact of the matter is, unlike America, which has, two oceans on either side, and the Canadians, whom obviously you don't trust, and the Mexicans, whom you trust even less, but you're building a wall there on the other sides, America is a slightly easier to defend, and even America had the 9/11 attacks, right? Europe can only protect itself if it becomes A, resilient, and B, integrates its Muslim population. Those two are tall orders, and we haven't done enough there yet. Pulling up drawbridges, building walls, just isn't an option for us.
Although this attack will embolden the Le Pens, it will embolden the Frauke Petries.
You mean the right-wing populists,
yeah,
in Europe?
Exactly.
No doubt it will, but these people are emboldened by anything and nothing, as we can see, and as we can see from a certain presidential candidate here as well.
Right, who went from zero, went from a joke to practically having the nomination.
It doesn't, I think reality to them is a secondary concern. But yes, people are afraid. People are afraid of losing control, are afraid of losing security. And if they see the governments unable or unwilling to provide for a security, they're going to complain and they're going to be vulnerable to this kind of populist rat catcher. The truth is also that Belgium, where these attacks happened, is peculiarly vulnerable as a society and as a polity. As a society, because it does have a very large and quite alienated, self-ghettoized Muslim population with, I think, almost next to no governmental effort and inclusion. And it is also something of a fraught and fragmented state with a badly performing government. So Belgium, I think, is in some ways uniquely vulnerable. That's a concern for other Europeans, but it doesn't necessarily, and it's a concern in the sense that, you know, there are neighbors and lots of other Europeans live in Belgium. I have lots of friends there. That's
a concern.
Of course
you do. Just two things. One, did you just call Frau Petri a populist rat catcher?
Yes, I did.
Extraordinary. That's some rhetoric.
Well, I think it's a fairly appropriate. If I had the German language original in front of me, some of the things she's been saying, and her ilk have been saying, I mean, some of that is quite close to neo-Nazi language, and I think populist rat catcher is exactly the right word for that.
Let's talk about the vision of Europe. There's been a reactive sense to the EU can't handle some of the financial challenges that have been going on over the last 2 years. And we're looking now that the EU is being challenged on the security front. Is it better to deploy security on the external borders of Europe and find a way of being more cooperative on security within the borders of greater Europe as a way of making it an easy place to move around in and being secure?
I understand the question. There are a couple of levels of this to this. It's not quite as simple as saying, you know, if all the Europeans just were better organized, then this would be much easier to do. If it were a perfect world, obviously, we would have coordinated or even common European forces, police, and intelligence. That is an incredibly difficult thing to do because we are a union of 28 sovereign nation states who at the same time, for I think many of us, probably even my own country, Germany, which supposedly is the most powerful and largest one certainly these days, find that sovereignty under conditions of open borders and globalization is a fairly notional thing. The reality is that there are two levels that we need to pay attention to here. I think a state that isn't a nation state that isn't providing essential government functions such as safety and security, and that's what's happening in Belgium, is a problem unto itself. It doesn't need Europe for that, and it's not going to be helped if Europe does that for it. If Belgian police and intelligence were as good as they should be, we wouldn't be talking about the European part of this. The reality, of course, is that terrorists cross borders, and therefore we need cooperation across borders. Okay, but even if we had that kind of cooperation, or even if those police and intelligence forces were unified and Europeanized, we'd still have a problem with Belgian national police and security. Okay, so I think you have to tackle this problem at two levels. You have to improve nation state capabilities, and I don't want to blame the poor Belgians for this, or put all the burden of this on the poor Belgians. There are other countries in Europe, a lot of other countries, who have similar problems.
Constanze Stelzenmüller is Robert Bosch, senior fellow with the Center on United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Federal authorities in Brussels are poring over photos and videos from the Zaventem departures terminal and the Malbec metro station.
A judge has been appointed to go to Zaventem to quickly do everything to retrace the eventual perpetrators and to ensure there are not other perpetrators on the run. The Brussels Federal Police of Zaventem are in charge of the inquiry. They are viewing all the camera images at the moment.
Belgium Federal Prosecutor Frederik van Loo speaking at a news conference earlier today. Dealing with technology, street cams, and GPS data in crime solving is a lot like what coroners do with dead bodies inside the complex bodies of victims. Suspects and laptops and cell phones are clues, are digital trail that lead investigators to the truth. Digital forensics is a new important field, and investigators are surely following the digital trail of those responsible for the attack in Brussels. Jeff Smith is the associate director of the National Center for Media Forensics at the University of Colorado, Denver. He says digital forensics is all about staying ahead of the wizards.
The digital revolution just came, 15 years ago in full. And about that time, we were all thinking in the forensic community, how we're going to authenticate digital audio recordings, digital images, find out where they came from, because people can make edits and we don't know what's happened. About 5 years after that, we started finding all these different ways that we could figure out the same sort of things, where an image came from, where an audio recording came from. And it's a lot of the same idea. We just had to kind of find those pieces and put them into place. Electrical signals leave their own sort of imprint on a digital recording still. In the same way that a D is offset in the typewriter, right? And we can say, or a person can say, what typewriter that came from. A microphone could be wired in a certain way that the audio recording has some unique characteristic.
What kind of crimes do you work to solve using these techniques?
Everything. On the security and defense side, there's determining whether or not an image is authentic so that it can be trusted in terms of tactical decisions, right? And if it can't, then it's ignored. On the other side, in the criminal side, if someone's created an edit and tried to give a false impression so that they can make more money or hide an embezzlement, then when we find an edit like that, then we want to highlight it and put that forward in a court of law. So we don't ignore it in that situation.
Hardest problem?
Finding enough hours in the day to go through all of the digital media that's created. No, I'm serious. The number of gigabytes and terabytes of data for cases is enormous now.
Now, I thought that digital files were just a series of zeros and ones, and if I email something to someone else, there's no way to trace anything like that. A digital file is a digital file, right or no?
Yes, that's definitely true. But there's what's called metadata in nearly any digital file, and that metadata is data about the data. It's information about that email you sent. So it's not seen by the user because it's not needed to. It's seen by the computer. The computer will access that information and say, oh, this was an email sent to this person at this day. And that metadata is unique for the email that you're sending.
What's the technology that most concerns you in terms of being able to elude forensics, even though you have a certain amount of confidence about your ability to keep up with things?
Well, the toughest challenge is that technology continually evolves. So cameras are getting better and better every day. The technology by which images are stored changes in order to get better. So the compression scheme to get a raw image into a pack of data that can be sent easily, that changes. It's a continually evolving process.
Jeff Smith, Associate Director of the National Center for Media Forensics. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
To U.S. politics now, a record 27.3 million Latino voters are eligible to vote in the 2016 presidential election. In 2012, President Obama won 71% of those votes to Mitt Romney's 27%. Who can change that? With Donald Build the Wall Trump winning Arizona's primary, you have to ask organizations like the conservative Libra Initiative, funded by the Koch brothers, what impact they can possibly have in dealing with what Republican strategists say is the most important issue for the GOP, getting young and working Latino voters back or in to the GOP. Daniel Garza is the executive director of the Libra Initiative. Daniel, it would seem you have your work cut out for you.
Well, we certainly do with this lot, Mr. Hockenberry. It's a pleasure to talk to you. But look, our focus is on driving issues within the Latino community and making sure that we're setting an agenda that's going to prevent the bankruptcy of America and remove barriers to opportunity, keep America safe, and preserve our free speech, really, and uphold our constitutional values.
You are an organization that came into existence when?
About June of 2011, that's how long we've been around. We started off in Florida and Nevada, and now we're in 10 states with about 75 full-time staff and about 50 contracted workers with thousands of volunteers.
How many voters have you registered?
We don't do registering of voters. Actually, we do citizenship classes where we are working across the country to make sure that folks are educated about the issues as well. We do English classes, provide them to Latinos who are trying to, again, remove barriers to getting a good job. And sometimes that takes things like a driver's license, a health checkup, so the kids can go to school. So we're very active in the community to making sure that we develop the skills and talents of the Latino community to position them in the marketplace.
So you enable undocumented Latinos to get driver's licenses or only citizens of the U.S.?
Both. Wherever the law allows anybody to get a driver's license so that they can drive safely on the road, so that they can travel safely, cash a check. All these things are critical to the, you know, the quality of life of an individual. So we feel that public policy should allow people to flourish. And for us, you know, those are free market policies that allow people to flourish, to prosper, to be self-reliant, and with a focus on personal responsibility.
So you have very little in common with Ted Cruz, then?
We have a lot in common, actually. We align very much with Ted Cruz on a lot of what he is about in upholding constitutional principles and values, making sure that the rule of law is sound, sound money, of course, free trade.
But not driver's licenses.
Well, look, if you and I agreed on exactly everything, one of us wouldn't be necessary, right? You know, we all have differences. We don't align exactly on everything. But, you know, you take the whole of what you align on and you try to work together and collaborate. You know, there are things that we agree with the Democrats as well, you know, on the liberal side. We're not beholden to any party, to any one individual. We will drive the issues that we feel are going to be important to America and make America strong and prosperous.
I'm going to ask a question now, and I don't want you to feel insulted by this, but,
no.
You know, the Koch brothers, you've described them as the two of the greatest Americans ever. We were quoted in thestreet.com. There are your employers. It was quoted in the same article. If you look at Ted Cruz, you look at Marco Rubio, it seems that, you know, and then you look at Donald Trump winning Arizona and also winning Latino votes all across the country. It seems that Latinos are not buying this self-reliant, came up from immigrant poverty story, and you have the similar kind of story, backed by, you know, gringo billionaire money. And it seems like Latinos are saying, no, no, we're tired of this. We want somebody who can change things. Donald Trump is that.
So, well, you're right. I do admire Charles and David Koch very much. I align with them on a lot of the issues. I respect what they have built, a very successful company that has created thousands of high-paying jobs, which is the kind of productivity that we need in America. But if I could say also that I understand that they contribute to Freedom Partners, and it's Freedom Partners that contributes to us. So they're not technically my employers, but I don't want to pretend that I'm disassociating from them. Again, I admire them very much, and I welcome the association. Let me just say also that 2014 proved very successful, actually, for freedom-oriented candidates, which tend to be Republicans. In this case, you know, you saw Cory Gardner get 45% of the Latino vote in a heavy Latino state, which is Colorado. But you also saw that in Brownback and Roberts, who got over 45% of the vote in Kansas, in Perdue and Deal, who got over 40% of the vote in Georgia. Scott in Florida, that got 45% of the vote. You saw that with Christie, who got 51% in New Jersey. You saw Cornyn, who got 51% of the vote, and Abbott, who got 45% of the vote of Latinos. With Sandoval and Martinez, governors of states, those are very successful Republicans with Latinos.
Well, the story continues, and 2016 is certainly fascinating no matter where you look. Daniel Garza, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mr. Hockenberg.
Daniel Garza is executive director of the Libra Initiative. Interstate highways destroy neighborhoods. Public transit connects them. It's an old story, starkly told in the classic Robert Moses tale of transforming New York City in the 20th century into now overwhelmed highways while the subways and light rail systems languished along with the paved-over neighborhoods they once served. But the momentum has shifted in urban America. Centralized city living is more efficient. It's perceived as greener, cheaper in some cases. And the billion-dollar highways that put a concrete bootprint in the Rondo neighborhood of St. Paul, Minnesota's black community back in the 20th century are seen as bad planning for the 21st century. So the Twin Cities has built a light rail connection allowing residents to travel from St. Paul to Minneapolis, from the airport to the far northern suburbs. The Green Line opened in the summer of 2014, along with another light rail line, rapid bus system, and commuter rail, all interconnected, huge investments in public transit. Commissioner Tony Carter, representing District 4 in Ramsey County, St. Paul, joins me now. How does it feel to have all that new stuff to ride on?
It feels great. It's wonderful to hop on the Green Line, visit along the line, be able to get on the line and see neighbors and friends and talk and relax and get to your destination on time.
And parking, that's just not a word you use.
Parking is a word that we use. We've certainly used it a lot as we plan the Green Line. And in fact, we've been working through new solutions to add parking back to University Avenue as possible in areas where it will fit. We still have parking there, and we should have more soon.
The thing that is interesting to me is that, you've got this is an efficient way to do urban planning. I mean, as expensive as a line is like this, there are so many benefits that come from it. How did you formulate the argument that allowed you to win the lawsuit that built the line along the University Avenue corridor? Because originally it wasn't necessarily going to do that.
As you look at the benefits, not only for getting people to places and spaces, as I said, but also for development along the line, for the redevelopment that we are seeing now that has been so tremendous for employment and for economic opportunity to grow the economic engine within our community along University Avenue, we have been able to win people over to the fact that this line is a benefit not only to St. Paul and Minneapolis, but certainly to the entire region and to the state. Moving forward on the line was actually an economic imperative as well as a social imperative for our entire community.
If you look at the Twin Cities, you've had two different stories of infrastructure over the last decade. One, of course, was the collapse of the Interstate Bridge that was such a tragedy that was really the result of stalled maintenance and crumbling infrastructure that we hear about so often in our politics in the United States, postponed maintenance, that sort of thing. And then we have the happy story of the Green Line. What's the lesson there as you look broadly at the imperatives for dealing with infrastructure in a city like Minneapolis-St. Paul?
I think the lesson is that infrastructure is extremely important to our lives. We depend upon it. We suffer when we do not invest appropriately in maintaining and improving the infrastructure that we need for our lives. And that's all kinds of infrastructure. You think about the places to which we've come over the past 20 years or so in technology and in the opportunities to, you know, get to places with the click of a button that we could never have gotten to before. Well, our physical infrastructure is like that too. And we must enhance it so that we are able to improve our lives continually. Certainly, we cannot risk that our infrastructure would crumble underneath us. We have to make the investments to continue to build it up. The light rail, the Central Corridor light rail, is a part of that investment. As I said, the development that it creates for all of us, not just the physical development, but the social development, is important as an interconnection for our lives.
She represents District 4 in Ramsey County, St. Paul. Commissioner Tony Carter, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Well, if there's an exhilaration that comes from seeing new bridges, shiny, clean airport and transportation hubs, there's also a demoralization that comes from city facilities that are falling down in disrepair that say, no money, no vision, help is not on the way. America's crumbling infrastructure comes out of the tap water in Flint, Michigan. You can see it in the bulldozed neighborhoods in Detroit. Aging facilities in Cincinnati, Newark, Boston, Los Angeles, the list goes on. Not even the presidential candidates shy away from this one.
We are crumbling.
We can't figure out what to do with our infrastructure.
There's no reason the federal government should be in the business of deciding what roads and bridges to build in the state of New Hampshire.
To fix our roads, our bridges.
We need a major investment to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure.
But not much actually gets done. And where it does get done, people are smiling. But nationally, not much of a policy. What's the problem here? Philip K. Howard is chair and founder of Common Good, a nonpartisan reform coalition which seeks to bring common sense to government. Philip, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
Now, you know, I hate to bring this up, but I just happen to have traveled to Australia. I went from JFK to LAX to Brisbane Airport and did a little traveling around Australia. And I have to say, you know, as prosperous as we are here in the United States, I mean, compared to Australia, and I've also had the same experience traveling in Europe, I mean, the United States is a dump, I mean, in so many ways.
Well, it is a dump. The problem actually is not money. Infrastructure, most infrastructure projects pay for themselves. Studies of this, you can finance them. There are all kinds of private partner, public partnerships now that can finance these things. The problem is that we have so much process, ironically, so much environmental review that we can't do projects that are good for the environment. So we need to get our act together.
That's the vision piece. In Flint, there's also a safety and danger piece here. Talk about that for a little bit.
Well, Flint involved a number of problems. First of all, it was an operational tragedy. Somebody decides to save money by changing the water source. They didn't understand that the old pipes would react badly to the new water without certain chemicals. They actually had notice over a year ago that the water was a problem, but the state's Department of Environmental Quality said, oh, it's just an isolated incident, and didn't do what would be obvious, which is to actually test the water around town. Finally, some university tested it and realized a few months later and realized that this was actually, tragically, you know, almost killing people. So that was an operational problem, but it stemmed from the fact that they had an ancient water system that nobody understood.
America's infrastructure was built, you know, at the end of the Gilded Age and in the industrial sort of peak of the 20th century, when there was huge wealth surplus from the rising industrial economy. And that seems to be the case in China, where there is huge surplus, excess growth, and they can make these investments relatively painlessly. Other countries seem to be able to do it without that surplus. Why do we require it to be such a gold rush before we do anything?
Yeah, you know, it's not a money problem here. We've been studying a new tunnel under the Hudson River. It's going to cost $20 billion, and we're going to do a forum in a few weeks on this. We have to have this new tunnel. If we don't have the tunnel, one of the old tunnels, because it's been damaged, 100 years old, will have to close down, and it will be an environmental disaster. The traffic jams, the capacities go down 75%. You know, it's going to be really bad. If we could approve that tunnel so the shovels can be in the ground next year, 2017, which is realistic, it will cost about 25% less and would be better for the environment. But no one at the moment has the authority to do that. So I was down in Washington recently talking with the White House about this. You know, we need an executive order just to do what's obvious, to get the shovel in the ground.
Finally, because I just love asking this question, bullet trains in my lifetime, please, Mr. Howard, please, please, Santa.
Absolutely, if someone can actually have the authority to do what was done 100 years ago, which is you're going to have to condemn some land, you're going to have to create new tracks that go straight between, you know, Boston and New York and Washington. And to do that, some people will have to move and will have to pay for that. And we can go from Boston to Washington in 2 hours.
Or Chicago, St. Louis.
Absolutely.
St. Louis, Denver.
All those things. But we have to be committed to making choices that actually affect some people for the greater good. And that's kind of what government's about. But we've created such a kind of a jungle of red tape around each project that literally no one is in charge.
Philip K. Howard is chair and founder of Common Good, a nonpartisan reform coalition which seeks to bring common sense to government spending. Philip, thank you so much.
Thanks.
We end this program with a conversation with a diplomat from Belgium with the many challenges ahead. Belgium began an official 3-day period of mourning yesterday as the nation attempts to recover from Tuesday's deadly bombings in Brussels. An intelligence failure following the success of Friday's raid, which captured Salah Abdeslam, an architect of the Paris attacks. The tragedy adds pressure to a country already mired in a history of political divide formed along linguistic and cultural lines for over a century. How will Belgium move forward? Joining me now to discuss Belgium's future is the Ambassador and Consul General of Belgium, Mark Kalkoen. Welcome, Ambassador.
Thank you.
And let me say, just right off the bat, our grief, your grief, our prayers, your prayers. This is a period of mourning. Your thoughts?
Indeed, we are really not used to this kind of situations because Belgium used to be a very peaceful country. We never had this kind of attacks. It's the worst one since the world wars that we were going through. And that's already a very long time ago. We had some instances of domestic violence and domestic terrorism in the 80s, but that was nothing compared to what we have now. Of course, we are not alone in this because many other countries and many other cities, both in Europe and across the world, have gone through this kind of attacks. But still, it's a big shock. We were a kind of maybe expecting it, but still it came as a surprise, the scale of it. The timing of it, and also the places that they chose, and the rapidity with which they acted.
There was so much talk about how expected this was, that Belgium's luck had run out. I'm wondering if that does relate to the history of being invaded twice in the 20th century. When the armies move, they step into Belgium first. Not so much the case in the 21st century, but if the shoe's going to fall, it's going to hit Belgium. That's a sense that I get from all of the leaders in Belgium reacting to this.
We have our geography. We are located at the center of Europe. We are located at the nexus of north and south, east and west in Europe. And then, of course, we have always been an open and cosmopolitan country. And Brussels is one of the most cosmopolitan cities in the world, with I think that every nationality is really there. And I just saw the news reports that like 40 or more than 40 nationalities are implicated in these attacks as victims. So that just shows that we always have been a very open society through which people pass. People come to us. We have always welcomed people. And we have had a lot of immigration. We have had many people coming from Northern African countries. We've always welcomed them. Most of them have behaved like you and I do normally. But unfortunately, there are some rotten apples that have chosen to act otherwise.
Does the multilingual quality of Belgium create a security risk in the sense that people can disappear into enclaves? And in fact, Malbec is something of an enclave. At least that's how it was described after the Paris attacks, where people could move relatively freely from in and out of that neighborhood into operational terrorist status in the midst of Paris.
I don't think that our constitutional system as such makes for this kind of situation that people can just disappear. It's rather a fact that we had a lot of people immigrating. And then, like in other cities, both in Europe and in the United States, I think some old industrial locations are being left by the natives, and then they're taken over by immigrants or they decay. In this case, in Brussels, so many people from Northern African descent went to live there. I don't think that our linguistic divisions are the cause of it. They might make it more difficult for the police and the security forces to work together and to get the grip on things, because you have to work in many different languages, and it all makes the situation more difficult. But I don't think that this is a big contributing factor.
Although you describe that decaying infrastructure and changes in industrial economies and the abandoned factories, that sort of thing, become opportunities for people to move into who are immigrants, maybe not natives. There was a comparison on this program yesterday, a French Middle Eastern analyst described what's going on in Belgium as not dissimilar to the chaos in Somalia that becomes a breeding ground for terrorist chaos. It was a shocking comparison that he made very casually, you know, accounting for the fact that he's French and French love to make judgments. Nevertheless, do you think?
Indeed, I'm a bit surprised coming from a French citizen to make such kind of statements. I think they should maybe also look closely at home, because the banlieues of Paris are not exactly the example of good living together and of being without strife and without problems. But notwithstanding this, well, it is a problem. We have not always succeeded in integrating well these people, sometimes because these people do not want to integrate themselves, sometimes because we were unable to, sometimes because we were not really successful in doing it. So there's many explanations that you can give for that.
And assimilation is a two-way responsibility, the immigrant and the embrace of the country that mm-hmm. is hosting.
Yes, certainly. Yes, yes. And from the other side, it is expected that you respect everyone, that you respect the cultural, religious, and other difference that there might be. But you might also expect that the people who come to you live in peace and make a normal life.
Who in your family and friends in Belgium was closest to the bombings yesterday?
Well, we have a son, and so he was working one station away from where the Malbec metro station. And so when we heard it early in the morning, we tried to call him, but he did not answer. But that's a kind of youngster who does not always pick up the phone when his parents call. So
You smile now, but I don't think you were smiling yesterday.
No, well, not really. But anyway, so but he had to start work very early, and he was busy at work, and he didn't even know what had happened until people started contacting him later on, and then we heard that everything was okay. But of course, life is difficult because there's no public transportation and so on in the city. So I think for the coming days, many people in Belgium will be stuck in a difficult situation. And in general, I think that it's a kind of our lifestyle that will have to change, because we were always very easygoing. We were laid back as a people normally. And I don't know in what sense this will have to change or this will change.
Well, certainly you were lucky. Others not so lucky in Belgium. Our heart goes out to them. Mark Kalkoen, Ambassador and Consul General of Belgium since 2012. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.